Hi everyone, I'm Heidi Rogers, and this is Tell the Others. I wanted to create a place for meaningful conversation, life lessons, and parenting hacks. Sometimes I chat to interesting people, sometimes I answer questions about parenting or life stuff, and sometimes I just rant. These episodes are filled with stories and insights that made me say, ugh, I just have to tell the others. So let's dive in to hear what we can learn today. Child is 15, doing online school, mostly getting the work done, attending all the lessons, not really into it, not really leaving the house. School holidays, he'll leave the house with me for 20 minutes a day to get a drink or food. We'll walk to the corner shop with me most days to get a drink or food. What happens next? I get family asking me, what now? How are you going to fix this? Or how can you even put up with this? Or why don't you do anything about it? It's very difficult, and having to deal with everyone else is just as hard. What have you tried? We've removed most demands, and generally the family is now very calm. We are all getting on well, but our 15-year-old spends the majority of the time in his room. He has quit all sports and doesn't have any in-person friends after the bullying and school refusal. Optional, is there anything else happening? Bullying, school refusal. So in summary, what do I do next to get my son doing more? No assessment, no medication. So first of all, I want to send you a big virtual hug, and any other parent that has a kid who is isolating and going into their room or just has a teenager, because I think that it's a very challenging age. Two things I want to go over. First, I want to go over the expected behavior from a teenager of what you can be looking for. I'm just going to write these down so I don't forget. The expected behavior of a teenager. And then secondly, the expected behavior of this particular teenager with everything that he's been through. And then the third thing is, what do we do with everybody else? And what do we do with the Janets, as I call them, or the Karens who have their, annoying questions and their observations and comments and whatever. So, okay, first, the expected behavior of a teenager. And if we're looking at stereotypical development for an adolescent, the period of about 12 till 18, 20 is called individuation, is a better way to put it. I like that term. It's the technical term that we give to teenagers. And individuation basically means I am in this new phase of development. I am no longer a little child that wants to be connected and associated with my parents and my family. I want to pull away and become my own person, because at 18, my body, society, or 20, my body, society, my friends, my culture will tell me that that's what I'm quote unquote supposed to do at this age and stage of my life. And in order for me to do that, I need to start pulling away and I need to start being a bit more by myself, figuring things out for myself, aka making lots of mistakes. And I need to learn how to walk on my own path now in baby steps at ages 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, so that by the time I get to that age of between 18 and 22, I think I would say for most kids, because in that next stage of young adulthood, I'm expected to fly the coop, leave the nest, do my own thing. If I want to get to that point where I'm living independently, I will need to start now, 12-ish, to pull away. What's that going to look like? Saying no, denying, refusing, things that maybe in the past were doable, not doable. The kid that you used to have who asked to hang out with you, the kid who asked for you to kick the footy or color with you, watch TV, play Uno, A lot of parents say, I don't know where my kid's gone. I miss that kid. And there's a real grieving process that goes through the adolescent stage because we as parents remember all of those nights where they just wanted mommy or daddy and rocking them in the rocking chair and us being the great almighty, the you have the ability to soothe, you have the ability to kiss the boo-boos and make it better. And they get then into this new stage where for us, we're like, huh? I don't like this new role I've been given. I don't like this new job assignment. I can't kiss it and make it better. Wait, what? You don't want to rock with me in the rocking chair? You don't want my comfort and my attention? Geez, it used to work, and it worked for a long time. Didn't work once, didn't work for 6 months. We're talking years and years and years that, excuse me, we all parents are conditioned for years that that's how our relationship is and that's the dynamic. And as you guys all know, a 1-year-old and a 5-year-old, there's different levels of independence and wanting to go do their own thing, right? And so you start to see it when they're little that they start to sort of pull away, right? And they start to want to do their own things. And adolescence is that next stage of the same thing. It's just a lot more ramped up because it activates for a lot of us our own anxieties and our own stuff, but also a lot of our own unprocessed stuff from our own adolescence. And most of us have legacy baggage wounding from our adolescence because it's such a volatile time emotionally with hormones and development, with social things. One of the most interesting things in research that I saw once was they looked at a in a functioning fMRI, like an fMRI is the F stands for functioning, so it's like it's on in like a different way. They'll give someone a problem to solve or something like that, and then look at their brain while they're performing the function. And when they look at brains of adolescents, and how they perceive and experience social wounding or emotional pain. So things like, say, not being invited to a party or something like that, that we as adults would deem a bit simple and like, come on, there's bigger, things to worry about in the world. When they look at an adolescent brain in an fMRI, the way that the brain experiences the emotional pain, the wounding, it looks the same as like an adult who's processing the death of both of their parents or loss of a child. Like the way that the brain lights up for significant, extreme, painful loss in an adult brain, let's say it lights up like a Christmas tree, and they look at the adolescent brain, it lights up exactly the same way for stuff that is sort of perceived by adults as silly. So just the way that they are heightened and wired during the adolescent period means everything is so much more intense. Everything is so much more extreme. So when it, to us, it might seem like they're being dramatic or being whatever, it's not their fault. This is how their brain is operating during that stage. The other thing that happens in the adolescent period is, and why it kind of impacts most of us for the rest of our lives, besides the obvious one that we often make a lot of mistakes, but when you make a mistake at that age, they can often be quite catastrophic or quite long term. And that could be in terms of driving recklessly and killing someone, there's just, yeah, there's a lot of legacy that comes from adolescent pain and wounding. It lasts long, usually, because the stakes are higher. But another thing that happens to the adolescent brain is the way that it lights up, the way that it gets like joy and positivity and oxytocin, endorphins, serotonin, all the good hormones is different the in how the adolescent brain gets it. And one of the biggest ways it gets it is risk taking and doubling down on that risk taking whilst with peers. So the research on adolescent risk taking is fascinating. And really helpful in understanding, why did you do that? That was so stupid. When I hear parents say that to their teenagers, because if I was by myself, this is what the research shows. If I was by myself and the opportunity was there to speed, drive recklessly, shoplift, be a bully to someone else, in front of all my friends and to look cool and like the tough guy. If I was by myself, say, I wouldn't do it because that part of my brain doesn't really get much reward. But if I have an audience of peers, not grandmas, but peers watching me, because they're in the car with me and I'm driving, or I'm at the basketball game and my friends were all together in a big group, the way that the brain feels rewarded and excited by the combo of risk taking whilst with my friends is like next level enjoyment, the brain would say. Maybe in the same way as like, I don't know, how could we relate to that? Like a shopping spree or, a weekend off of parenting, a weekend away by yourself, to a spa. Whatever you dream of and your brain lights up like, I love that. That's what a teenage brain does when it comes to risk taking and being with their friends. So essentially, the brain loves risk taking with friends during this stage of development, and that's where it gets its biggest hit, its biggest juice of happiness and joy. And when you're operating through a phase in a period of life where you have a lot of hormones that are doing the opposite and making you sad and, everything is horrible, existential crisis stuff, you can see why the appeal of wanting to feel good mentally, is such a strong pull. And so this is why teenagers often get themselves into ridiculous situations because their brain is kind of seeking and driving risk-taking behavior with their friends. Okay. So that is what we would call sort of stereotypical average development, normal sort of stuff. So this whole thing of being in their room a lot and wanting to isolate and be by themselves is very, very, very normal for teenagers. What a lot of teenage parents say to me, though, is, yeah, but where's the line? Because I'll have friends that have teenagers come over and then they'll see how often my kid's in their room and they'll be like, oh yeah, no, Susie's not in her room as much as, Jack is. Jack is like always in his room, it seems. But like, yeah, no, Susie comes out and we'll watch movies and stuff together. And then the other parent will be like, oh, well, super, because now I feel even more horrible about it and stressed about it because a fellow teenage parent is saying that they don't have that same experience. So I think checking it out with a professional, is smart to say, well, what are we looking at here? Are we saying out of, an entire day, they're emerging from their room for only 10 minutes or what, 10 seconds, what, 10 hours, what's it looking like? So that's one, I think, is checking it out with a professional. And I think in your question, you said you guys go out for 15, 20 minutes to go get something to eat or whatever. If that's it, if that 20 minutes is all we're talking about, and then for the rest of the time he's in his room, that concerns me because that's like too much. That's on the spectrum end of that's too much time. Where it gets hard is if why he's in his room is for video games or which I'm assuming is what it is that the computer is where he wants to be. Some possibilities with that is putting the computer in a more public place, like the dining room, the kitchen, the living room. Obviously, I understand that's not always feasible and doable with how houses are laid out or, the noise of it or whatever. But that would be probably my advice to parents that are coming into this stage would be if you can try to set up computers or devices in public areas so that they can't kind of one, get into mischief, but two, isolate and, hole away for ages. That's my ideal if we can have the computer set up in a public place. Anyway, but I get it. He's 15. the ship has sailed somewhat in that he probably already has the computer and stuff in his room. But I think where I go back to with that, okay, so sorry, that's expected behavior. Okay, we went through all of what doesn't surprise me about this question is his age, and that this is somewhat to be expected of the pulling away and individuating, and I need to create distance from me and my family so that I figure out who I am. And we all remember that. Like, I remember that in the 90s, listening to my depressy emo music, and reading the liner notes on the back of the cassette or CD, figuring out who I was and journaling and all of that angst. We all remember doing that, right? The difference is that this generation has the internet and social media and a constant sort of barrage and onslaught of information and emotion and, in psych language, nervous system poking and nervous system d dysregulation ability that is all through their phone and or their computer. They have this ability to poke their feelings, to be bullied, whatever, constantly through tech, right? Where I get stuck though with this kid in particular is if bullying and friendship social stuff exclusion was part of the wounding that he experienced at school, video games then, if it's multiplayer, which I'm assuming it is, and he's playing with other people, because you made the point in your question about that he doesn't have in-person friends. I love the fact that he has tech. I love the fact that he has online friends that he can game with. I love the fact that he has a social network, and he has people online that he would consider friends and people that he gets to hang out with, right? So I think we got to kind of zoom out and look at what's our problem here. Because if he was a teenager in ideal settings, situation, which I'm assuming would be that he's out with his friends and he's out with his friends playing sports. He's out with his friends at the mall. He's out with his friends at a park, whatever. But he's out with his mates doing safe stuff, not causing trouble and things that they enjoy. I'm assuming that we all would go, yay, I'm doing a good job. My kid's doing a good job. We all win the we're doing life badge because he's doing what he's supposed to do. Heidi says he's supposed to individuate and he's supposed to pull away and hang out with his mates. And that's what he's doing. He's going out and doing those things. The difference is, though, for him, understandably, because he had wounding and like a scary situation that happened for him socially with his friends, his brain went, not doing that stuff with friends at school, not safe. They're going to hurt you, let you down, reject you, whatever. I'm going to go into my computer and that's where it's going to be safe. But essentially, he's doing the same thing, right? He's going out into an apocalyptic zombie landscape or Mars or a racetrack with his friends on a computer screen, right? If we all lived in a virtual reality world, let's say we all had the goggles and let's fast forward, 200 years in time. Maybe that's what it's going to look like the Matrix, where you lay down in a chair and plug in, and then you plug into an alternate reality. I don't know. But like, he's doing the same thing, isn't he? He's hanging out with his friends, and they're not causing trouble. They're not graffitiing and vandalizing fences. They're safe. They're not doing drugs. They're not drinking. They're not doing the things that we're traditionally scared of with teenagers. They're safe. He's playing with his friends. He's socializing and hanging out with people who get him. He's socializing and hanging out with people who think he's smart and competent and want to play with him or play on his team or survive the zombie apocalypse with him in the bunker. So there's a lot of needs that the video games are filling. There's a lot of inherent connection that he's getting out of his video games. Which is why I'm so passionate about video games and why I get so frustrated when they get turned into the villain by a lot of professionals and by a lot of parents. Because I don't think, of course, there's a villain component for sure. But that, I mean, that's like saying, Water is bad. Like, I mean, you could die from having too much water. You can die from having too many apples. Like, you can die from anything that's too much. Video games, sure, but like, there's a lot that is good that comes out of video games and a lot that is healing. And I think that that's part of what he's doing. I don't know what kind of games he's playing. I don't know the content he's consuming. So that's another conversation that I think you could have, or watching, him. But the biggest thing I tell parents of, I mean, kids of all ages, but especially teenagers, is we have to meet them where they are. What is the world that they live in? Where do they like to play? What is important to them? What lights them up? And so for parents of teenagers that like video games, that's, I want to learn how to play Fortnite. I want to learn how to play whatever it is that they're playing. It's sitting down, getting the controller or putting on the headset and getting on your computer and learning how to play and asking questions. Okay, so I saw when you killed that zombie, you switched your ammunition and you used different bullets. Why? Oh, because the diamond bullets kill them faster. Got it. Thank you. Onward. You would be amazed at how hard these games are, and how much skill and planning and insight and responsible stuff. I was playing a game with my kids yesterday where it's a new game, so I'm still learning it. And you have, your vital signs of water, hunger, and then overall well-being, which is denoted by a heart. And so you have to be watching all of your vitals to make sure you don't die of dehydration, hunger, and overall well-being. And I said to them, "Oh, my thing is going down that I need to eat. How do I get food?" And they said, "Well, you have to catch a fish first, then you have to cook it, and then you can just leave it on the barbecue for when you are hungry." And I was like, "Oh, that's a lot of like foresight and planning ahead." And I was like, "Oh crap, I'm about to die." And my 8-year-old goes, "That's okay, mom. I already made a lot of fish. It's in one of the resource chests." And I said, "What do you mean you made a lot of fish?" And she goes, "Well, it doesn't, you're not going to play the game well if you do it like that. You have to plan ahead." Is this the same kid who can never plan ahead in real life? Hilarious. I was like, "Oh, okay. So, huh?" She goes, "Here, I'll show you. This is how you catch a fish. You got to get this kind of hook, da da da. And this is how you cook it." So she's showing me all of that. And then she's like, "And then you put it in this resource chest so that when you do hit that hunger thing in your status bar, you can just go straight and get it and you don't have to, catch it and cook it and everything." And I was cracking up inside because, how many times I criticize her in my mind that she doesn't plan ahead and, doesn't think about getting her shoes on or whatever. And I was like, "Wow, you actually are thinking ahead." And how did that happen in the game that she would have died a few times in the game because she hadn't planned ahead? So then, after that last time she died, when she started that next round, what did she do? She did a whole bunch of fishing, a whole bunch of cooking, and then stored it, right? So she learned the hard way, as most of us do, about what she needed to do to survive. That's exactly what this kid is doing. He learned the hard way what he needs to do to survive. And so for him to survive, that looks like I can't do school. School is too hard. I have to do online learning and I have to do friends and socializing virtually. I have to do it on a computer. I don't think it's fair for us who are not him to judge or criticize that that's the right or the wrong way to do it. I feel like if all of us had lived his exact experience, and we still don't even know exactly what happened. Like, we know that he was excluded, we know that there was bullying, but we don't know because he's not a big talker. We don't know exactly what's happened and what was said or done, or we don't even know the whole story. But man, to me, like, I mean, not even as a clinician, as a human being, if I think about all prior to that, he was socializing and doing stuff and doing sports for the most part. He was engaging in life, and then this bullying stuff happened, and now he's saying he feels safest in his room playing virtually. That doesn't add up, does it? That says to me, whoa, something big happened here. Either constant bullying over a long period of time, and any of us who've experienced a glimpse of bullying or someone being consistently excluding or mean know how painful and damaging that is. You know, I've had a lot of adults tell me, I never really understood bullying until this year. And they're like in their 40s or their 50s. It didn't happen to me at school, but man, this workplace situation or this manager or this whatever, I've never experienced bullying and I did not know that this is what it was like. And I feel so bad for all the kids out there that have to go through that. So many times I've heard adults, men especially, say that to me, that they're like, it's so bad. It's so hard. So to me, I trust him. I trust this kid. I wasn't there. I don't know what happened, but something big happened over a course of time or in an instant. But something big happened for him to completely cash in all of his chips and stay at home. I trust him. I trust that he knows what happened and he knows that he does not feel capable to navigate that. So if he's saying he needs to hibernate in his room for a few years, I go, okay. I trust you. I get that. I get that. But this is the caveat. We have to have some sort of conversation, some sort of dialogue, some sort of something needs to be going on so that I can feel like I'm a bit more in the loop rather than out of the loop with what's happening. So many adolescent clients have taught me things like, I said this, I did this, I told my parents I didn't want to go to school. I told my parents I wasn't going to go to see the GP or the psychologist. I said, I'm not going to do my chores. And do you know what's crazy? They believed me. They just like took my word for it. And they were like, okay. And we'll have this conversation about, well, so I'll be like, so that's not what you wanted. That's not what you meant. And they'll say something like, no, I told her to shut up and go away, but I really wanted her to come and sit down and hug me. Or I really wanted her to sit down and go, hey, what's going on? That's not you. What's happening? Or I said, there's no way I'm going to go talk to the GP about getting, you know, medication, or I'm not going to see that psychologist to get an assessment. No way, not a chance. And so you said that because, well, I don't know. The whole thing sounds weird and it sounds overwhelming. And I think that they're going to just get mad at me and I'm going to get in trouble or I'm going to be shamed into my behavior over the last year. Right. So you actually think that it would be helpful for you? Well, yeah, I think it would be because I know what I'm doing right now isn't working, but I just don't want my parents to think that. I don't want my parents to know that. Right. So a lot of times I think teenagers will say or do, and adults as well, will say or do double meaning. They'll say this, that's not really what I meant, or that's not really what I wanted you to do. I wanted you to fight me, or I wanted you to push back. I wanted you to challenge me. Right? And they're sort of surprised, I think, when we fall for it or we take the bait on the first, no. They want us to push back a little bit more. And persistence is a thing, right? I would keep persisting. I would keep saying to him, because I know at the beginning, when mom first joined and asked these questions, the first sort of behavior was he was so angry and he was so reactive. If anyone brought anything up about school or seeing a therapist or getting an assessment or anything like that, he was so reactive. Now that he seems to have calmed down a lot in his nervous system, from what you've said in this question, that he seems to be a lot calmer, it's a lot like chiller environment. that says to me, let's try again of talking to him about seeing someone or GP medication, whatever. Now, side note, a lot of times I will tell parents scripts of stuff to say or do this, whatever. And in situations where I was working with the young person, and I might have a session where I tell their parents to use this script about the constantly coming home after curfew or the drug use or the alcohol or whatever. And then the young person would come and see me, and I would go, how'd it go? You know, what did they say? And they'll regurgitate what the parents said. And I'm like, you know, face palm, face palm, face palm, just going, that's not what I said. And that's not how I said to say it. Oh gosh. Okay. And I'll find that there is a loss in translation sort of thing that happens where when I say to a parent to talk to their kid about whatever, how it actually ends up coming out of their mouth is totally different. And that's human. That's okay. But I'm just mindful of the delivery and how the going to see a GP or going to see a psych, how that conversation is handled, or maybe how it was handled in the past. And so what I would like to say is for the future, let's forget about how it was handled or dealt with in the past with this kid. But I think moving forward, if you guys say something to him, something along the lines of, and this is the tactic I think that I would go as well for kids who are resistant to seeing a professional, because to me, that usually says the reason why I don't want to see a professional is because of the shame. Fair, makes sense. So, how can I alleviate shame? By making this not about you, by making this about me and what I'm doing wrong. And I believe that if we can say to him, I want to go see someone who specializes in teenagers because I need to learn as your mom what I could be, should be doing to help you through this period. Because I'm just a regular human. I did not study for 8 years, all of the things that psychs do, parenting, behavior, adolescence, blah, blah, blah. I don't know, dude. I'm a rookie. I'm, even if this is your fifth kid, even if you're a high school teacher, I'm not an expert on you, sweetheart, at this age. This is my first time parenting you at 15. I knew you really well at 7 and 8, but every year has been new and every year has been novel. And so here we are today, and I'm at a loss of what to do. And I know that you would know deep down in there that there's stuff that I'm doing that sucks and doesn't help. And then there's stuff that I'm doing that's helpful. But my thought is if you can share that stuff with someone else, they can then regurgitate it back to me or help me see the blind spots, help me see what I'm missing. Because I feel like I'm missing something. And you don't deserve that. You deserve a great mom, family, adolescent experience. And I feel like I'm missing something. And that's not your responsibility to figure out. That's mine because I'm the grown up. But one thing I think that is your responsibility is your overall health and well-being, because I can't force you, right? I can't force you. I can't force what you eat. I can't force exercise. I can't force sleep, you know, good sleep hygiene. I can't force any of that stuff. And I know you don't want to feel miserable either. But if I'm going to improve my parenting game, and if we have to get at least to 18, so if we got to get through at least the next few years, I think it would help both of us if we go talk to someone who can give me some tips and insights on what's going on for you so that I can support you better. And then I would say that and read the room, see how he responds to that. He might go, oh, or he might go, fine. But I would try that conversation again and make it more about you and I need to learn some stuff. Because I think a lot of times what happens, because I've had a lot of kids that have come to see me, and that was when I spoke to their parents, how I kind of said, see if you can pitch it this way. And that's then what worked to get them to come in and see me. Because that's like my opening line with every teenager I've ever worked with is something to the effect of, I know this isn't how you want to be feeling or how you want to be acting, especially when I worked in the like juvenile justice system, working with those kids who were, violent and hurting other people. That was always my opening line to sort of stand down, shame, board member. I know you're a good kid and I know you don't want to be this way. And I know that you're frustrated and pissed off that the grown-ups don't seem to get that you are not choosing this. Why would you be choosing this? That's always where I will start. And I will also then start with, but dude, you got to tell me what they're doing wrong or what school's doing wrong, what the other adults around you, what they're doing wrong and what sucks, so that I can communicate that to them and get them to change. But I can't do that unless you tell me what they're doing and what's sucking and what's happening. And then that usually will lead to a little bit of a, once they realize like they're not in trouble or they're not there to see me for criticism, I make it all about how we can change the adults. Nothing to do with you. You're fine. You're fine, teenager. You're fine. We're just here to change the grown-ups. That then sort of bodes me goodwill. They feel like I get them. And then the second part of that is, we're not focusing on them. We're focusing on this thing over here. Because you focusing just on me, too intense, too much. So then when we focus on the grown-ups and what the teachers, the parents need to be doing differently, that's then where I will Trojan horse, I guess, my way in to teaching them how to communicate, conflict management, emotional regulation, as they tell me those stories. Is then where I will build their skill and teach them how to emotionally regulate or whatever the missing skill is, right? But I don't think we can often push people to therapy or push people to getting help, because how it feels to me is shamey, othering, rejecty. This is why you should go to therapy. This is why you should see someone. Like, it doesn't feel nice to hear that, you know? So I would revisit that conversation, because in the same way, if he had a physical ailment, if he had an arm that was getting infected, do you know what this reminds me of? Is like, you know, when your kids are little and they have like a splinter or something and they like wail and freak out at the thought of you touching it or, doing anything to it. It gets to a point though, depending on, I mean, a splinter in some aspects, I guess you could just leave or soak or whatever, but you know what I mean? Like, if it's a broken arm or a compound fracture or something, it's like, dude, I hear you that you don't want to go to the hospital, you don't want them to fix it, but like, like your bone is sticking out of your arm, like, we have to go and we have to get this treated, you know? That's sort of the line I feel like we're at, where it's, he's saying, I don't want to go to hospital to get the fracture reset, And then what comes up in us, I think, is panic, which is what sounds like too. I'm hearing from some of the other family members that you were talking about who are saying, what are you going to do? Is this seriously? He's just going to get away with this? Like, when they're saying all that stuff, I imagine if it was a compound fracture, that it's sort of that same energy, that same vibe of like, this is dangerous. This isn't safe. What's going to happen? Which is all meaning well, but I hear you. It's not helpful, and it's not what you need right now. And I think what a lot of people don't understand is, because they've not walked it, they've not lived in your shoes, they've not walked in the trenches that you're in, they don't see all of the things that you've tried, and also the fatigue. You've been doing this for a long time. This is a long time that since he first left school or started refusing to go, which you guys know the new phrasing on that. It's not school refusal, it's school can't. And that's now the new term that us progressive woo-woo hippies are using, is school can't. Because refusal denotes a sense of choice, doesn't it? I'm refusing to go makes it sound like I'm picking this. Whereas what we know now from research is there's no choice. There's no choice. It's my nervous system and my brain are being hijacked by overwhelming feelings, and I feel so dysregulated at school. I can't. I can't. It's like swimming with shark refusal. Do I have, Heidi won't swim with sharks. Yes, she has swimming with shark refusal. No, Heidi has swimming with shark can't. I can't. Nope. Could not do that. It's not refusal. But I'll give you $1 million and private jet for life and blah, blah, blah. Could you do it then? Nope. It's not refusal. I can't. I'd love to. Can't. That's the problem, is a lot of the adults in mainstream society would be looking at him going, those parents are ridiculous. You know, they should just say no video games, and then that will make him buckle up, buck up, and come out of his room. And you guys know, you tried that. It doesn't work that way. It doesn't work. It just creates more disconnection. But can we just want to read this one line of your thing again. He's mostly getting the work done, attending all the lessons. Not really into it. I'm all right with that. Generally, the family is now very calm. We are all getting on well. Dude, I'm sorry, but isn't that sort of what we were aiming for? This sounds like a lot of improvement. If I think back to where you were, I don't know, a year ago, this sounds like a lot of improvement. Things are much more calm. He's at least attending school online, but still he's attending most of the stuff. He's not into it. I'm all right with that, but he's showing up. Like, this seems like a huge improvement. Maybe that's what you say to people when they go, really? You're just gonna let him play video games all day? Yeah, because he's improved a lot. I know this is hard for you to wrap your head around, Janet, but this is a huge improvement for him and for us. A year ago, we were fighting constantly, all of us. The whole temperature in the house has changed. It's a lot more doable in our house. The way that it is now, I can handle. How it was a year ago, I could not handle. It was horrible. So yeah, this is a lot better for us. And as far as what are we going to do? We're going to go slow. We're not going to rush him. And my priority is my relationship with him. Everything else is noise. His academics, his sports, his whatever, that's just noise. I'm trying to keep my kid alive. And so for me to keep my kid alive, I have to prioritize our relationship. Because if I don't have a good relationship with him, if I start doing the punishments and the taking his computer away and restriction and not allowing da da da, all that does is creates distance and disconnect between us. I can't afford that right now. He's hanging on by a thread. Okay? Back up, Janet. Back up. I think too, some of your answer to that comes from trusting yourself, right? And having confidence in yourself that you're a good mom. No, you don't know what you're doing. None of us do. And if you meet a Karen who thinks they know what they're doing, good luck to them. Go write a book, start a podcast. Cool. I don't know what I'm doing. And I'm winging it with all of my kids every year of their life. I'm winging it. I'm trialing and erroring. I'm making mistakes. I'm 3 steps forward, 2 steps back, because this is a new person to me. Every year they change, grow, evolve. And I change, grow, and evolve as their mother. And so this kid in front of me at 15, who's not been going to school and is now going online, is new for me. Even if I did this 5 times with his brothers before him, it is new for me because he is a different person. This is a different experience. It's as unique as a thumbprint. This is my first time. That's the reality. And that I think is also why we all feel so shit as parents a lot and lacking confidence and lacking self-esteem and beating ourselves up because we feel rookie and novice every day. And I think that that's accurate. We are rookie every day. I have never known this child at this exact age and this exact situation. 7,000 variables that are different to this kid than siblings. So have grace, have compassion on yourself. Yeah, it is hard. I don't know what I'm doing. Even if you were a professional, I am a professional. You got like I teach this stuff. I wrote a course on it. This is what I do for work. I see seven people a day talking about this stuff. I still struggle with it. I still yell at my kids and lose it. And I'm super dysregulated, say stuff I don't mean, say stuff I regret. I have kids who fight and who hit each other and they hate each other and love each other and play lovely and then play horribly and da, da. I still have all of that too. I will have a teenager who lies to me, who steals, who shoplifts, who drinks underage, who cheats on tests. I will have a kid that does all of that stuff. I'm not immune to that. Why? Because I'm human and my kids are human. And that's part of the human experience is being messy and screwing up. That's the gig. Doesn't mean I'm a bad mom if my kids do all that stuff. And so it does not mean you're a bad mom that you have a kid who's homeschooling, online learning, staying in his room. Does not mean you're a bad mom. Because bad moms, which I don't even agree with that because I still think there's a reason why they're being like that. But anyway, the moms that we would judge and label as she's a bad mom, they don't stop and reflect. They're not on a call like this with a Heidi asking these kinds of questions. They're not staying up late at night worrying about their kid. You're a good mom. You spend a lot of time worrying about him. You spend a lot of time reading and listening to podcasts and trying all the things and let's do vitamin D supplements and let's stop meat and maybe that will help. Like you're trying all the things. You talk to him like a human. You don't talk to him like he's beneath you. You don't power trip on him. You apologize when you get it wrong. You meet him where he's at. You're trying your best. And unfortunately, this is one of those lessons that we've learned from babyhood with our kids. Me trying my best is sometimes not good enough to get the outcome or the behaviors that I want. Yes, girl, I know. Same, same. And that is not a nice feeling when I'm trying my best, I'm busting my ass, I'm doing all the things. Why is that not good enough? I know, because it's just, it's not. We can't control kids. We think we can. And then at some point we learn we can't. And so I think one of the fundamental things that comes up in parenting is this disgusting realization of the groundlessness that comes with parenting and having children. I can do all the things, but at the end of the day, I still can't control them and force them to do things. I know it's hard. Doesn't mean you're doing it wrong, though, if that's your experience. It means you're human, having a human experience. And for the people out there, for the Janets that have their kid doing the things and ticking the boxes and, you know, being all perfect and have their shit together. Cool. Good for you. I look forward to working with your child when they're an adult and they're processing all of their repressed emotion that was not safe to express in your household. Thank you. Because that's exactly what happens. I'll see them. They'll end up on my couch at some point. I might see them when they're 40, 50, 60. You can't avoid it. The only way out is through. That's the gross part of being human. I want to avoid, I want to suppress my emotions. I don't want to feel, stick my head in the sand, put that experience in a box in the cupboard. It'll come out at some point. Parenting is a very, very hopeless gig. Constant feelings of helplessness and sitting with the reality of my lack of control. And that's very anxiety provoking, especially when we're talking about our babies because we love them more than anything. So, in summary, we went over expected behavior. Hopefully, this normalizes a little bit of why teenagers isolate and stuff. But just because they want to isolate doesn't necessarily, we just let them and are like, whatever, stay in your room for, 5 years until you mature. No. We encourage, come on, what do you want to watch? I'll watch something with you on Netflix. MasterChef? The baking show? Cool. Is it cake? Sure, let's watch that. What will you watch? What board game will you play? What video game can I play with you and you teach me the ropes? Meet them where they're at. Asking him again about speaking to someone. Dude, I will have a chat to him. If he would get on the phone with me, I will totally have a chat to him and say, hey, I'm helping your mom with parenting stuff. Give me the tea. Tell me what I need to know of what I need to tell her that she's got to do different. It's a phone call. Throw my name in the ring. I am happy to chat to him and say, what should I be teaching your mom? And I'm sure that it will be, all the oh, the horrible this and the horrible that. And I'll go, yeah. And maybe if it's me, if it's someone else that he's able to have that conversation with, then we can maybe get somewhere about figuring out what's going on for him. And then as far as the family questions, I think it's saying to them a script, a sort of PR, perfectly calculated, cultivated response to say at the press conference, something to the effect of, thank you for your concern for him and for me and our family. I really appreciate your concern. We're handling it the best we can. This is actually a lot better than where we've been. And him being alive and his mental health is my number one. And I know if I want to be able to help with that, I have to have a good relationship with him. And having a good relationship with him means I prioritize connection and things like punishment and restriction and taking things away from him or not allowing him to do things. We've tried that, and it just leads to more disconnection and not any kind of relationship. And I can't afford that right now, because if I lose my relationship with him and the little bits that we do have, my little 20-minute walks a day, I lose him completely. And we need to have someone that has access. We need to have someone in this family that can get through to him and that he will open up to for 20 minutes a day. So thank you, Janet, for your concern. I will reach out and let you know if we need your help. But at this point, your validation and empathy in our situation would actually be the most helpful. Dropping off lasagnas, that would be the most helpful, you know? But do you guys see too, for those of you with younger kids, do you see why? And this is why I love having this program where you have adolescent parents and, people with babies and people with primary school kids. Do you see? Like, this is why I'm always preaching connection, 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 relationship, relationship, relationship. Because when they get into this stage, what do you have? So I'm going to take your phone, you're grounded, whatever. Cute threats. And what, at 2 a.m., you're going to put a lock on their door and a lock on their window? I mean, you can, but you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't work. And then also with mistakes. Do you know how many adult clients I've seen in my career? How many clients that had to get an abortion or something to that effect when they were a teenager because they had no relationship with their parent and they couldn't talk to them about it. And they had to go through that whole thing alone, like hundreds. We want to create the kind of relationship where our kids come to us when they make a mistake, or our kids come to us when they're suffering and hurting, so that we can help them through it. But it starts little and it starts years before you get to the teenage phase, where we're creating a relationship and creating a dynamic where it is safe to do that. And so even this kid, this 15-year-old staying at home and not going to school is a, to me, is a reflection of the relationship hard yards that mom did before. What does that mean? He was able to be open and honest about not wanting to go to school and sharing a little bit about the bullying stuff that went on, and then feeling safe enough to express, I don't want to go to school. A lot of other kids shove their emotions even further down and force themselves to go to school and suffer, 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 mental health deteriorate, 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 and then they end up in a very horrible state. So the fact that he felt safe enough to tell mom, I can't go to school, I'm not going to school, and expressing himself and like being himself at home is hugely validating to me that they've done something right along the way, that he's been able to express that and be honest about how he feels about going to school. And so I think, I'm playing the long game, you know? Playing the long game.
If you're a parent or a professional who works with children and you want my help in improving things with the kiddos in your life, or if you're simply a human being feeling kind of stuck and maybe kind of overwhelmed, my online programs have lots of resources, transformative content, one-on-one coaching, group coaching, and a supportive community. If you want to learn more, just go to HeidiRogers.com. All right, friends, thank you as always for tuning in today. Our time is our most precious asset, so I truly appreciate you sharing your time with me. I'll see you right back here for the next episode of Tell the Others.